And we are joined once again on The Green by contributor Larry Nagengast. This week, we were going to talk a little bit more about education advocacy in the first state with part two of our two-part series, but events kind of overtook our plans. And with the settlements agreement in the education funding lawsuit that the state faces, we had to pivot to that. And Larry did, and we appreciate him doing that and now joining us to talk a little bit about what we know and what we don't know about what this settlement means for education funding in the first state. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So, Larry, there's a lot of ground here to cover. Let's start with the biggest piece of the puzzle. That's the codification of Governor Carney's opportunity funding in Delaware. First, what does this look like going forward under the settlement?
Okay. Well, first, opportunity funding was an initiative by Governor Carney. It's now in its third and final year to pump an extra $25 million a year into schools that have high proportions of low-income students and English language learners. The agreement calls for continuing opportunity funding at higher levels, at least $35 million a year for the next two school years, then at least $50 million and $60 million in the following 2 years, and after that, increasing it based on the rate of inflation. So 3 years from now, opportunity funding will be at twice its current level, and that will continue to grow in the future. There's also a provision here that says that $5 million of these opportunity funds will be used each year to provide mental health and reading support services to schools that have a population that includes at least 60% low-income students and or 20% English learners. And by the way, there will be a requirement that the districts and charter schools that receive these funds must prepare an annual report that details how that money is actually used.
So why is codifying this funding so important?
Well, codifying is another way of saying that the state will make this spending permanent by writing it into Title 14 of the Delaware Code, the chapters of the code that deal with education. Up until now, the opportunity funding has just been a line item in the state's annual budget with details about how the money can be spent included in the epilogue portion that's attached to the budget. Now, those line items in the budget, the epilogue language, that can get tweaked. It can even get deleted by the budget writers on the General Assembly's Joint Finance Committee. Now, if opportunity funding becomes part of the Delaware Code, then this is treated the same way as the main pieces of education funding, things like salaries for teachers and administrators and the regular allocations for building maintenance. And these items are set by a formula and they cannot be eliminated.
Now, there are, of course, other funding pieces to this settlement. Can you tell us a little bit about them, and is there anything here that's new or kind of exceptional?
Well, I was saying no. There's nothing that's new in this at least in the sense that these are all items that, in one way or another, Governor Carney and some members of the legislature have been pushing for over the years. But what is happening here is that the funding under this settlement would be more extensive than in the past. Okay, so first, for special education students in kindergarten through third grade, the state will provide districts and charter schools with funding through the same formula that is used for special ed students in fourth grade through high school. Until now, the funding for these special ed students had been just the same as for those who don't have special needs. And Delaware, for years, has been one of just a handful of states that don't provide weighted funding for these students. Next, funding for the state's early childhood assistance program, essentially pre-kindergarten programs, will double from $6.1 million to at least $12.2 million for fiscal years 2024 and 2025. Also, at least half of that new money, roughly $3 million a year, would be directed to community-based preschool programs that are not run by school districts. Third, for fiscal years 2023, 2024, and 2025, the state will allocate an additional $4 million a year to support enhanced teacher recruitment and retention in these high-need schools.
So beyond the funding, there are some other pieces in this settlement agreement. Let's start with one of them, the required independent funding assessment. Do we have any sense of what that could look like or what kind of impact that could ultimately have on funding in Delaware?
That's a big if. This could be a really big deal, or it could be just another report that gets piled on top of the other studies that have been conducted in the last 20 years. The idea here is to hire an outside consultant, someone that has no connections to the state, to look at total funding levels, both state and local, and how that money is raised and how it is distributed, and to make recommendations that would improve efficiency and fairness in these allocations. The report would have to be completed by January of 2024. The wording in the settlement, though, suggests that there's no guarantee that the findings in this report would have to be adopted. So there's a chance that nothing could come of it. Or, if you want to think more positively, this could finally be the report that spurs the overhaul of a complex education funding system that has been talked about, well, since maybe the dawn of the 21st century.
And there's also a new ombudsman position that's required as part of this settlement. Tell us about that and what function it will be performing.
Well, okay, I'm going to call this the J Street paragraph, and I'm naming it after the longtime Wilmington education advocate who represents Delawareans for Educational Opportunity, which is one of the plaintiffs in the school finance lawsuit. Back in the 1970s, J Street was essentially an ombudsman, protecting the interests of minority students from Wilmington who had voluntarily transferred into suburban schools and then faced suspensions for behavioral issues. If you remember, we talked a little bit about this last week, how the splitting of school districts after desegregation had made it harder for advocates like J Street to provide this assistance to Wilmington families who needed such support. Under the settlement, ombudsman services would be set up in each county, giving students and parents assistance in dealing with principals and school boards if they thought students were being treated unfairly in things like discipline, class placement, or access to other programs. Now, there seems to be general agreement that this is a very much needed service, but some people that I've talked to say that these problems still aren't going to go away until we solve the much larger underlying issues. And we're talking here about the trauma that's caused by poverty and hunger and violence that many low-income kids bring into school every day of their educational careers.
So we've talked a little bit now about what's in the settlement. Let's talk now about reaction. Is there some consensus among those who have been working on these equity issues for some time now? And have any concerns been raised about whether or not this settlement does what needs to be done?
Okay, well, a couple of points here. First of all, there's a lot of positive forward motion in this settlement, but most people that I've spoken with say that it still isn't enough. For example, people are saying that the extra money that it would be spent through this settlement amounts to roughly a 5% increase in overall education spending. So 5% on top of what we're spending now is not really huge when you consider the annually inflation, tends to kick that up by 2-3% anyhow. And also the people advocating changes in the funding structure note that the settlement does little to change the way that $1.5 billion or so that's allocated every year is actually spent. Secondly, as always, the devil is in the details, and the settlement does not go into a lot of detail. Let's take, for example, that extra $4 million for teacher retention and recruitment. How's that going to be spent? Will it attract high-performing teachers into schools that are filled with low-income students and English learners? What kind of boundaries are going to be set when the roles of these ombudsmen are defined? Now, another piece that I haven't mentioned yet is the Certificate of Necessity equity statement. And what this piece of the settlement means is that when a school district asks the state to issue bonds to pay for building a new school or for renovating an older building, it will have to describe the demographics of the students who would benefit from the construction project. Now, historically, there's a good reason for this provision. In Newcastle County, anyway, when new schools have been built in the last 30 years or so, almost all of them have been built in largely white middle-class communities and not in the city of Wilmington. So this new equity statement requirement will make people at the state level more aware of who would get the most benefit from construction projects, whether it's going into schools that have large minority enrollments or which have enrollments that are more typically representative of the broader population. But that in and of itself is no guarantee that more new schools are going to be built in low-income neighborhoods.
But perhaps a more crucial people we need to hear from are lawmakers, because of this much we do know, especially with funding, because what we do know is this: the funding needs their approval. What are lawmakers you talk to saying about this settlement and the populations it'll affect?
Well, the one thing that's kind of interesting is that some of the legislators I talked to wished they had known a little bit more about this mediation as it had moved forward. And one of them even said he thought that the state might have gotten a better deal if legislators had been involved in the negotiations. Now, I understand that point, but the legal reality is that the plaintiffs in this case sued the governor, not the General Assembly. So the General Assembly didn't have any standing to get involved in the case in that respect. That said, you might think that the legislators wouldn't be happy that the governor now is in a position where he's essentially telling them they pretty much have to enact the legislation that he proposes in order to satisfy the terms of the settlement. But the reality is that what I'm hearing is something a little bit different, that the legislators just might be inclined to allocate more money or to accelerate the spending timetable beyond what Governor Carney agreed to in the settlement. Now, also, the legislators seem to realize the difficult situation that the state was in once this lawsuit was filed. I mean, it's very hard to deny the inequities that exist, these disparities in funding and in academic performance between low-income and middle-class communities and the students that live in them. You know, all of this is very well documented. So there was broad recognition that if the state didn't settle now, the judge handling this case could very well order a more costly remedy later on.
Of course, the bottom line is, will this stuff get through? You've kind of hinted that perhaps the legislature might be willing to do more. Governor Carney has said he is very confident that the General Assembly is going to get behind this and get it done. Does the governor have reason to be really confident that this is not going to be a heavy lift?
Well, yes, he certainly does. Now, you know, we've talked previously in how in years past, the General Assembly has been the roadblock to education reform, especially when it involves low-income or minority students. But that started to change in 2018 with the elections in the off year, and it's certainly going to change even more with the November 3 elections in 3 weeks now. We're seeing younger, more progressive legislators winning elections, and a lot of them made education a big part of their campaigns. You'll remember when we talked about this mediation in August, I said that I was quite skeptical that it would end with a settlement. Now, no one is quite sure what the governor actually was anticipating, but I happen to believe that the results of the primary election in September really gave him more confidence that he could negotiate a settlement that he would then be able to successfully sell to the General Assembly.
So it does sound like things are on the right track to get done, but we have to look at the flip side, and that is, you know, what are the consequences if it doesn't get lawmakers' approval?
Well, that's one where I can give you a really simple answer. If the recommended spending and the legislation that's needed to implement it is not approved by the time the General Assembly ends its session on June 30th, the plaintiffs can go back into court and ask the judge to set a trial date. And the kids who have been hurt by inequitable treatment for many years will not get the help that's been sought to keep them from falling behind until the suit would eventually be resolved.
So finally, we do want to check in on the other piece of this lawsuit. That is the part about county property assessment. And to be clear, this settlement does not have any impact on that second piece of the lawsuit where the property assessment system in the state was found unconstitutional earlier this year.
So
where does that stand?
Yeah, you're correct about that, Tom. The suit has been split into two parts, and the settlement that was released on Monday does cover the state track. The county track concerns these outdated real estate assessments that each county uses to determine property tax payments. Now, Vice Chancellor Laster ruled in May that this system violates both state law and the state constitution. Now, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, he has given the counties until the end of October, to another 2.5 weeks, and that's a month after this year's property tax payments were due, to get a handle on how the tax collections actually went this year. I mean, it would not be surprising if collections fell behind the levels that the counties normally receive, because, you know, with foreclosures and people being out of work, they might have had trouble paying their taxes. So anyhow, in another couple of weeks, we can expect to hear about a schedule for filing briefs and holding hearings, and then that part of the case will pick up again and move ahead and move towards its conclusion.
Larry Nightingale, as always, we appreciate your time. We appreciate your reporting, and we look forward to talking to you again next week when we get back to what we were supposed to do this week, and that is the second part of your education advocacy story.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.